Welcome, everyone, to episode 436 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have a jam-packed episode for you today. We had a trade out of nowhere on Friday, so we will break down the Kemba Walker, Al Horford blockbuster. We will also preview the Western Conference Finals. We will do a semi-Eastern Conference Finals preview. We're recording this on Sunday before Game 7 of Sixers-Hawks, but we will give takes on Bucks versus whoever. We'll also get into some drama in Dallas and in New Orleans. So before we get to all that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And joining me today is someone whom I would wish Happy Father's Day too, but apparently Denmark is way ahead of us. So, Morten Jensen, just how's it going?
It's going well. Much like in any other area, we're way ahead. that's over with. No, but Happy Father's Day. This is your first one. I hope that Noah gave you a big poop.
He actually did blow out yesterday and all over a pair of my shorts, which I hope is not a metaphor for Sixers-Hawks Game 7, but I guess we'll find out later tonight.
Yeah, get used to it. That is, you'll never unsee that again. That'll be stuck in your eyes for the next 25 years.
Yeah. Well, speaking of giant poopy diapers, the Celtics and Thunder made a trade on Friday, Mort. Basically traded unwanted contract for unwanted contract was the yes. Centerpieces of this. So Kemba Walker, along with the 16th overall pick and a 2025 second round pick, going to OKC for Al Horford, Moses Brown, and a 2023 second rounder. My first reaction was just to laugh because I just thought it was very funny that 2 years after the Celtics did not want to sign Al Horford to that contract, they are now bringing Al Horford back on that contract. But what was your take of it from the Boston side of things?
Well, I was just glad they did it because I've been very vocal on this podcast just in terms of that they needed to get out of Kemba. Yeah. Like I think that knee is problematic. There was $73 million left on that contract. I could definitely see a scenario wherein he would come back next year and be significantly worse and significantly less productive mm-hmm. because of that knee and because of like the age. He's no spring chicken either. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a good idea to get out of that thing. Now, do I think that Al Horford is someone who's going to come in and like fill a major need? No, I don't. And I realize that Boston fans do, which good on you guys. I don't think he's that guy anymore. Like he can be a nice complimentary piece. He's not going to be worth his contract, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then I just wonder what the hell the plan is there because they got Moses Brown, they have Robert Williams. Like I would just like to figure out who are they betting on here and what's the play. And finally, like at some point we need to figure out how Sam Presti does it. So he got a pick to get to take on the Horford contract. Yep. And then he got a pick to get off of the Horford contract. That's amazing to me. And regardless of what you know anyone thinks about having this type of process of rebuild, this is a guy who understands how to maximize assets.
Yeah.
Like he just that's just a non-starter. I'm really fearful in some ways that we're going to see a complete Thunder ownage for the next 12 years with all their draft picks.
Yeah, well, I'll get to the Thunder momentarily, but it is like the opposite of like Russian nesting dolls, where they're just taking worse and worse contracts and they're getting picks for each one. So like I'm excited who they trade Kemba Walker for next year get a pick. I feel like it's probably going to be John Wall or Russell Westbrook.
Oh, Westbrook back to OKC?
Yeah.
And then get another pick to actually get him after they got like four picks to wow.
Right? It feels like it's destiny at this point.
It really does. My God.
Yeah.
Why? We really should talk at some point about just giving Presti like Executive of the Year award. Now, I know people are going to say, well, we don't know what the draft picks are going to turn into. I really don't care.
Right.
Like what he's done here is just so impressive. Like just in terms of optimizing you know, that asset base and just giving yourself so many bites at the apple, like, I think that warrants consideration.
Well, I wrote a piece at Forbes the other day about, I had written this thing like weeks ago at this point. I was planning on dropping it after the draft lottery, and then I had to rework half of it because the stupid trade came 4 days before. But the Thunder are pulling off the process, but better. And I got in a lot of trouble on Sixers Twitter for saying that. But to be fair, the Thunder also started from a better place. They started their rebuild having traded away Paul George and gotten way more for him than they should have. They, you know, they traded away Russell Westbrook. Then this past year, Dennis Schroeder, Steven Adams. Then they started trading some of the guys they got. You know, Danny Green went to Philly for Horford. So yeah, like, this is the template.
And they have SGA.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So they already have a star. They have a ton of cap flexibility, and they're nailing a lot of these moves on the margins as well. Like, take a Moses Brown, for instance, whom they signed to a two-way deal. They signed him to a four-year deal in March. That's like less than $2 million a year. He ends up starting, I think, 32 games for them, averaging around 10 points, 10 rebounds a game. Then he's included as a sweetener in this Horford deal. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, we still have, you know, Lu Dort is signed to an incredible contract. We have Kenrick Williams signed for two more years as well. Yeah. They have a number of, you know, like the Poku and Darius Bazley, Ty Jerome. They have all these guys on cheap contracts for at least the next two or three years. Théo Maledon. They have the rights to Micić, who just won EuroLeague MVP. And now they have, you know, probably still $40 million in cap space this summer. So they could either get, you know, throw an offer sheet, add a John Collins or a Jarrett Allen, someone like that. They could use some of that cap space to take on more bad contracts and take more picks. Like, the odds of them hitting, they're not going to do what they did in the late 2000s, where they got back-to-back-to-back MVPs in KD, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden. But I think the Sixers this year, and over really the past 5 years, have proved that you can mess up a lot if you just have the resources to do so. You can still be okay despite messing up a lot. Like, the Sixers are the number one seed right now and are one game away from the Eastern Conference Finals, despite tripping over their own dicks for the last 5 years. The Thunder have way more ammunition than the Sixers ever did. So, like you, I'm all aboard the Thunder. I mean, we talked, you know, we did the future power rankings a month or so ago, and I have the Thunder at the top of my list because they aren't guaranteed to hit on all these picks, but they have so much flexibility that there's almost no way they screw it up so badly that they're like the Orlando Magic.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And the only reason I didn't have the number one was because I prioritized, you know, known commodities at that point in time.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we're looking at a situation right now that is almost unprecedented. Like, people are, I did it myself, just said, like, the process 2.0.
Yeah.
Like the whole process moniker. This is like the process on steroids, though. This is something else. This is very, very aggressive. And I just hope that the NBA doesn't suddenly force them to hire a collegial.
It's only fair. They really should.
Yeah.
But
just one.
Or just don't fire Sam Presti halfway through. That's my best advice to OKC. Just tolerate this next, even if you lose more this next year, it's okay. Things will get better. But I mean, we'll see what happens at the draft lottery Tuesday. Houston could fall out of the top four, and then all of a sudden OKC could have, I mean, if like the lottery breaks perfectly for them, they could have two top five picks, plus number 16 from Boston.
And if that ends up occurring, they could trade up potentially for another top five pick.
And get like Cade Cunningham, Evan Mobley, and SGA.
I mean, yeah, like if they, well, three, right?
Yeah.
So if they could have, two already without trading up.
Oh, I see, right? I see, yeah.
So they could have three.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it's Cade, it's Evan Mobley, Jalen Green, I don't know.
Yeah.
Jalen Suggs instead. My point is, this is a really strong draft at the very top of it. Like, Cade, obviously, superstar, future. Evan Mobley, to me, in my eyes, projects as a proper unicorn. I already have him several levels above, like, someone like Kristaps Porzingis, for example. I think higher of him than I do Jaren Jackson Jr. I think he's going to be one of those cornerstone bigs moving forward for the next 15 years. And then there's Jalen Suggs. Like, if you cash in a lot of your chips and you get, like, three blue chip guys like that in a strong draft, then you're right, Brian. Then they won't draft an MVP in consecutive years, but they'll draft potentially three All-Stars in the same year.
Right.
I see. Well, my point is more along the lines of this. I think it would be a good idea to identify a certain draft. Maybe that isn't the one, maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think it is just smart to identify a certain draft where you go, okay, this is the one to have multiple picks.
Yeah.
This is the one to actually just have like four or five high up, because it's just loaded. Maybe this is the year. Maybe it's next year. Maybe it's the year after. I don't know. But I wouldn't be shocked if it's this year, because this year it's good. It is really good at the very top.
Yeah, we'll have more Thunder talk, I'm sure, after the lottery in particular. Because, like, worst-case scenario, I think they fall to 8. They still have 16, and they get 18 from Miami. So they're still going to have 3 first-round picks either way. So they still will have flexibility to move up if they want.
Right. I was saying 3 at the very top.
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope things break well for them. But
how would Twitter react if they ended up with the top 3 picks? Like, just... got 1 and 3. No, wait, they can't get 3,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Houston,
no, they can't
Houston
get 3.
Has to fall to 5.
That's true. Yeah, that's the top 5. Yeah, good reminder.
But from Boston's perspective, as much as I made fun of this trade on Twitter, I actually, I don't hate it for them. I understand Horford is, like, he's fine. He's going to be better than he was in Philly. He was passable in OKC. They shut him down because...
He was too good.
Right. They wanted to lose. So that's fair. He's not going to be the Horford of a couple years ago. If they're envisioning Al Horford coming in as being like the Embiid stopper again, Embiid is going to look at him like lunch food next year. Embiid's gotten better. Al Horford's gotten worse. It's just not going to be what it was a couple years ago. But it does, you know, they cleared, I think, almost $10 million in cap space. So it does make it more financially palatable to retain Evan Fournier in unrestricted free agency.
Right.
And like you, I feel like this is just the first in the number of moves. And I'm waiting to see the other shoe drop to see, do they, you know, I'm guessing they're going to try to get out of Tristan Thompson. They don't really have any need for him. What is this?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any doubt there.
Yeah, right. What does this mean for Robert Williams, who's now up for an extension? Because you have Horford signed for this year. He's got $14.5 million next year guaranteed already. You just brought in Moses Brown, who's under contract for 3 more years. You know, do you envision Robert Williams as your starting center moving forward? Are you willing to commit the amount of money that it will take to sign him to an extension? Maybe if this gives them flexibility, maybe they don't have to sign him to an extension, see how this year plays out. Maybe he doesn't play as much, drives down his price a little bit. They let him hit restricted free agency next summer and go from there. One thing I did find strange, this is from Adam Himmelsbach of the Boston Globe. He reported, some things I'm hearing in the aftermath of the Kemba deal. C's now feel better about their chances of re-signing Fournier, which makes sense. This doesn't necessarily mean Tristan Thompson's time in Boston is over, which does not make sense. Moses Brown was mostly added as a salary match, but will get a look. What am I missing there? Because Moses Brown is good.
Yeah, a whole lot. I mean, you're not missing anything. Whatever you're missing, I'm missing too.
Okay.
Apparently, because I don't look at it that way whatsoever. If you prioritize Tristan Thompson over Moses Brown, then you're off to a pretty rough start if you're Brad Stevens as GM.
Yeah,
like I wouldn't do that whatsoever. And Moses Brown, like, he had a 9.8.5 rebounds per game average in, I think, 21 minutes per game.
Yeah,
and he's 21 years old. He'll get a look. He'll get more than just a look. Are you insane? Like, of course he will. Defensively, he's not there. Like, he is still raw, obviously. I mean, he played for OKC, so it wasn't a winning franchise, but he'll get more than a look. I'm absolutely sure of it. He fits somewhat on the timeline of Jalen and Jason. He definitely fits that timeline a lot better than Tristan Thompson does, that's for sure. So, like you, I won't take that too seriously. honestly. I just wouldn't. It's not. He's not a throw-in by any stretch.
Right. Like, it would piss me off if they considered him a throw-in, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, wait, this guy's actually good. Like, they just fell ass backwards into Moses Brown. Because having him on that contract in particular is going to be such an asset for a Celtics team that has Jason Tatum signed to a max, Jaylen Brown signed to a near max, Al Horford taking up a lot of cap space this year, Evan Fournier is probably going to get at least 15 to 20 million per year moving forward. Marcus Smart, you have to worry about him next year. Robert Williams, like, they are in, you know, they are capped out unless they complete, like, clear the decks of Horford, Smart, Robert Williams, Fournier, not for more and more year. Then they can have cap space in 2022, but then they have a very barren roster afterward. Either way, you know, like, Moses Brown is a major asset to that team. For a team that signed Tristan Thompson using the full non-taxpayer mid-level last year, which was a huge mistake. Like, who would you rather have? Tristan Thompson at $9 million a year, or Moses Brown at $2 million?
Yeah. They traded six. They basically drafted Moses Brown at 16.
Yeah. And honestly, given their track record in the draft as of late, Moses Brown's probably going to be better than whoever they would have gotten at 16.
Known commodity. I think that was the thing. Like, they whiffed on at least a few draft picks here and there. So for them to know, okay, here's a guy who by 21 was averaging roughly 9 and 9. You know what? We know there's a certain baseline there.
Yeah.
So if we trade that 16th pick and we get him back, we know that there is going to be production. We know that he's not going to be a Romeo Langford or someone like Grant Williams or Semi Ojeleye, who's just kind of there, right? I mean, so no, I would be floored. Let me put it this way: I'd be absolutely floored if they didn't use Moses and if they just decided, oh yeah, he's like a third big, like he's fine. Like, if that's their approach, then something went wrong.
Yeah.
Probably so.
Yeah. All right, Mort. So Eastern Conference Finals are not set, but the Western Conference Finals are, and they start in roughly 1 hour. So we are going to sneak our Western Conference Finals preview in right under the wire. Although it's kind of hard to preview this series because each team is missing one key piece for an indeterminate amount of time. Chris Paul, based on reports, have tested positive for COVID. We do not know if or when he's going to return at any point in the series. Meanwhile, as we talked about last episode, Kawhi Leonard has an ACL injury. Both guys have been ruled out for game one, but that's all we know. They have not been ruled out beyond game one as far as we know. So they could come back. Conceivably, either guy could come back at any time. But I think for the purposes of our analysis, we should at least assume they're going to miss, I mean, probably most, if not all, of the series, especially Kawhi.
Yeah, Kawhi, I'm basically ruling out at this point. Like, I understand that it hasn't been reported as an ACL tear. It's been reported as an ACL injury. What the hell is that if it's not a tear?
Yeah.
What could that be?
I mean, it would be a partial tear, but...
Of course, but that was still... Like, it can't be an ACL bruise, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean...
Right.
I just can't imagine, especially with him going into free agency this summer, that they're going to put him at any risk whatsoever. So
right. That's why I'm also thinking he's out.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So we saw them without Kawhi for games 5 and 6, I believe, of the series against the Jazz. So we know what the Clippers will look like sans Kawhi. We also have seen a glimpse of what the Suns will look like without Chris Paul because he was effectively missing in action for games 2 and 3 of the Lakers series. So I'm guessing campaign is going to start for them at the point. Which of these teams do you think can withstand the loss of their star more in this series?
I would say Phoenix, but we also just saw the Clippers rise up and do something that you and I didn't think was possible.
Nope.
So I would be an idiot to sit here and go, oh, this is obviously Suns, because the Clippers proved both of our asses wrong.
Yeah.
And thoroughly so. But I mean, logic would indicate that Kawhi being the best player here means that the Suns should be able to weather the storm a little bit better because you're not losing an MVP candidate. And I, as much as I love Chris Paul, let's stop the whole MVP narrative. Like, he wasn't there. But no, I think Phoenix has this nice rotation of wings. You still have Devin Booker, who's your primary guy. You still have DeAndre Ayton doing everything inside. You know, Jay Crowder is there. There's so many weapons you can go to. Mikal Bridges is there. Cameron Payne, as you mentioned, coming in, and he's been playing steadily. So I just wonder if that's enough, because like the Clippers, who is their second guy now? Like, is it Reggie Jackson?
Terrence Mann.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's not a problem. Maybe they figure it out. Maybe this is like one of those, you know, situations where they rally because they've lost their best player, and then they're just going rah, 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 and everyone is like hyped up every single game, and it's enough. I honestly don't know. I predicting this series is one of the toughest tasks that I've had for the entirety of the playoffs. I have no clue what to expect from this one. I really don't. Like, you're completely changing the way that you play. Right. Like, Chris is very ball dominant, not in a bad way. Like, he just controls the offense. He's the maestro. He's the guy who makes the decisions, all that. Him not having that means the ball has to go through Devin. It has to go through Payne. It has to go through different avenues there. And with the Clippers, you just don't have the bailout score in Kawhi. Like, sometimes, especially in the Mavs series, where you just needed something, you went to Kawhi, and he would somehow, some way, pull something out of his ass, and he would get it done. Now you don't have that option anymore. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. So, this is a really tough one. I'm leaning Phoenix just because it's not as drastic a loss mm-hmm. as it was for the Clippers.
Yeah, I think both of those guys that are missing also present major matchup problems for the other team. But I think, like you, I'm leaning the Phoenix in the series just because I think they can withstand the absence of Paul, since they still have, you know, Payne and Booker figure to handle the ball most of the time. And I don't right. think they're going to go deep into their bench. Like, I doubt we're going to see Javon Carter or Langston Galloway or anything like that. I think it's really going to be those two guys. But then you also have Mikal Bridges and Jay Crowder, whom you can throw on Paul George. If Kawhi were healthy, you know, those two guys still match up pretty well with Kawhi and Paul. But, like, not having to worry about one of the top wing scorers in the league, now you can really change it up. If, you know, if Mikal or Jay get in foul trouble, just go to the other yep. guy. I think that's going to be a luxury for Phoenix that Utah in particular did not have. As we saw, you know, Utah's entire defensive scheme was built around Rudy Gobert, but their perimeter defenders were horrible in that Clippers series. They just got roasted. But I think one of the other interesting things to watch in the series is I expect the Clippers are going to stay small. I think, you know, seeing what they did, at least they'll start small. We'll see what happens. You know, if they get destroyed, maybe they change it up. But see what they did against the Jazz with that small ball look. You know, test DeAndre Ayton. See if you can do the same yep. things, like stretch him beyond his ability to, you know, get him out on the perimeter. And then that's going to open driving lanes as well for your guards. So I think, do you think Terrence Mann, especially after his 39-point performance in that closeout game, he's got to stay in the starting lineup, right?
I mean, you would be crazy not to when you got that kind of production. You want to ride that momentum. And even if he doesn't come out like gangbusters, I still think you need to give him that run. Like, give him 30-plus minutes and see what he does, because you can't have that kind of performance and then not show him some faith afterwards. Like, right. you have to ride that and see what's there.
Yeah.
You're missing Kawhi. You need to figure something out.
Yeah, right. You can't lean on, especially given the challenge Paul George is going to face in this series with those two,
right.
with Jay and Mikal. Like, backcourt defense is where you're going to make your money if you're the Clippers. Devin is not Trae Young, but he's not elite on that end of the floor by any means. So Reggie,
no, he's bad.
Yeah, Reggie Jackson and Terrence Mann are going to have to carry their load, or at least help Paul George out, because I think it's going to be a tough slog for him in the series.
Yeah, I would agree. And like, let's get to the Paul George thing, right?
Yes.
He's been great.
Yeah.
Like these playoffs. I mean, we're talking 26 plus points, 9 plus rebounds, 5 plus assists, 45 from the field, 36 from downtown, which is a little less. Like he hasn't had the three ball working quite to the extent that he usually does in the regular season, but you know, I'm not worried about it either, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Almost 90 from the line. He's been so good. And like, I think if there's a guy out there who can come in and sort of pretend to be the number one option and actually get away with it, it's probably Paul George. Like, I think that's fair to say because he can create for himself consistently.
Mm-hmm.
He can move off the ball consistently as well. Like, there's not at any point do you feel as though, oh, now he's hit his limit. Like, this is a guy who could absolutely go for 50 any given day. So for him to step into that role, I think it's a matter of mindset. I think it's for him to come in and just say, you know what? I can't scale back to the 21, 22 points per game. I got to do what Kawhi did in the Mavs series. I have to come out and average 33 plus. I have to come out and take 12 threes. I have to get to the free throw line 10 times a night. I have to do all of these things. And at the same time, as I do it, I need to be the heart and soul of the offense. But I have to be the primary playmaker, ball handler. And then defensively, I don't know if he'll have the energy for it, but he also needs to be the communicator right there. This is going to be gut check time for Paul George. But either way, like, he's been so good this year, and I'm just tired of seeing the slander online keep going. Like, he's proven people wrong, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that narrative needs to die now.
Oh, yeah. Playoff P is gone. Or Pandemic P is gone. Like
Pandemic P. Oh, yeah. Playoff P is very much here.
Yeah, I mean, 37-16-5 in that Game 5 victory. We're going in, we're like, oh, no, the Clippers are done. No. Paul George has been fantastic. I guess the problem for the Clippers in this series is that, much like Luka in round one and Donovan Mitchell in the Jazz series, having Kawhi and Paul George to guard Devin Booker is one thing. Having only Paul George to guard him as your primary defender, given the load that he's going to have to carry on offense as well, that could be tough for him to manage, especially considering the minutes that he was playing toward the end of that Jazz series as well. They have, I mean, like, I'm sure Reggie and Nick Batum and Marcus Morris and Terrence Mann are going to switch on to Devin at times. Beverly could be an interesting X factor, especially with Chris Paul, as long as he's sidelined. Because, you know, Chris Paul is not going to be bothered by Patrick Beverly. Campaign might be.
Yeah, that's a good shout. I think this might actually be the time to unleash Pat. Like, this is, you're going up against a very, very weak guard rotation. This is where you unleash him and you just basically tell him, go nuts.
Yeah.
Go nuts. go guard everyone. Go guard Devin Booker on switches. Go guard Cameron Payne. Just be this annoying little SOB that you can be. And we're completely removing all handcuffs on your limits, like minutes, restrictions, or whatever. Like, you can just go. By the way, you brought up Reggie Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
He's averaging almost 17 per game in the playoffs.
I was gonna,
like, he's back. Yeah. Okay. He's like back to Detroit Reggie Jackson.
I was going to ask who. So this came to me the other day because both of these guys are going to be free agents this summer. Who would you rather pay? Same contract in free agency, Reggie Jackson or Dennis Schroeder?
Oh, Reggie Jackson.
It's at least much closer than I think it would have been a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah, no, again, like, it comes down to playoff performance as well. I mean, I've been saying this for a long time now, and he is delivering in the playoffs. Look, the guy is shooting 43.5% from downtown on 7.1 attempts per game.
Yeah.
You know, he's hitting over 90 from the line. Sure, he's not a great playmaker. He's not a great rebounder. He's not, like, one of those, you know, otherworldly defenders. But he's a guy who can come in and score reliably so.
Mm-hmm.
That matters, and he does so while playing off of others. You won't hear the same issues that surrounds for someone like Dennis, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I would absolutely rather have Reggie Jackson than Dennis Schroeder if the money is the same, and I would definitely prefer Reggie Jackson on a lesser salary, which he's probably going to get.
Yeah,
like, let's be honest. Next year, Dennis Schroeder is likely going to get paid a lot more than Reggie Jackson, and I'm going to be sitting at back and laughing my ass off at whoever overpays for Dennis Schroeder and decides, oh, yeah, let's not go with Reggie Jackson instead.
Yeah, I mean, kudos to Reggie, because he could have, his career really could have gone one of two ways, and his improvement as a three-point shooter in particular has, yes, is going to help him age really well. I mean, what, 3 years ago, he shot 30.8% from three for Detroit. Now he's, I mean, this year he shot 43.3 during the regular season. He was at 39.3 last year, 36.9 the year before. So he's had his three best three-point shooting years over the past three seasons, and his percentage has gone up each of those last 3 years. It's, I mean, it's made him, yeah, it's what makes him a legit threat in the playoffs now. So I'm with you. I think X factor for Phoenix for me has got to be DeAndre Ayton, right? If the Clippers are going small,
right,
can DeAndre Ayton punish them for it more than Rudy Gobert did? And I think he can.
Like, okay, so yes, I think he can, but I don't think it's in the manner that we, like, envision. He's not going to come out there and go, I'm going to be averaging 25. I still don't think that's his mindset whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like, I agree with you. If they go small and you give him a post-ups or you make him rim run or you find him in the dunker spot, absolutely. But it's going to be one of those small volume dominance kind of things, mm-hmm, right? Like where he takes maybe 12 shots per game or something along those lines. Right. He's not going to go in and say, I'm going to get up 18 shots per game. I was looking this over, I think yesterday. Let me just look it up.
Yeah,
and he was averaging a ridiculously low amount of shots.
Yeah, is it 9.5 during the playoffs? Yeah, almost 72% shooting.
Like, I don't get that, and that's not on Ayton.
Right.
Like, that is one thing I don't get. I mean, clearly he's hitting his shots. 71% like kind of indicates that, and clearly when he's had seasons before where he was more offensively inclined. Like, when he was at Arizona, there was an offensive game there. I would really hate for the Suns to kind of pivot him into some sort of defense first, second, and third kind of role. And then offensively, he's basically just an opportunistic scorer. I'm not saying he should go all, you know, DeMarcus Cousins on it. But, like, you could give him more than 9.5 shots per game. Come on. Like,
well, so, with regular season, he took 53% of his shots within 3 feet of the basket. In the playoffs, that's up to 64%. So a lot of it, I think, is him just being selective with his shot opportunities. And I think you said it well. Right. Like, I'm not calling for just a bevy of DeAndre Ayton post-ups, because I don't think that's the way for Phoenix to beat the Clippers in this series. But can he take advantage?
Unless he scores on 71% of those
shots. Sure, yeah. If you're shooting 72%, analytics says you're probably doing something right either way. But no, I'm saying, like, yeah, can he dominate the glass? Can he, especially on the offensive glass? Can he just completely use his size, bully these guys out of the way, get putbacks, create easy baskets that way? Can they use him as a rim runner, as a lob threat? Like, he's going to be a couple inches bigger than anyone else on the floor. Can he take advantage of that? Because, I mean, the Clippers, they didn't play Rudy Gobert off the floor, but Rudy Gobert, I think it was like a minus 24 or something in that game six. Like, they took advantage of his time on the floor. If the Clippers can do that to Ayton, I mean, the Suns, I think, more than the Jazz, the Suns have the ability to downsize if they need to. They have Cameron Johnson, they have Dario Saric, who both of whom can shoot threes as well. So they can go five out, but they're at their best with DeAndre Ayton on the floor. So I'm curious to see how he makes his imprint on this series, because I feel like we know what we're gonna get out of most of the other guys. It's like campaign obviously is a huge X factor, just because, you know, we don't know when Chris Paul is going to return, and having to replace Chris Paul, who's been phenomenal in these playoffs, that's a tall task. But how Ayton influences this series, I think, may go a long way in determining which team wins. So, more again, we don't know when Chris Paul or Kawhi is returning, if at all. But given what we know now, which team?
Oh, gosh, you're going to ask me, aren't you?
Yeah, which team are you leaning, and how many games?
I'm not going to give you the amount of games because I don't know. Okay. I'm not that confident at all.
No, I'm not
leaning. Either. I'm leaning Phoenix, but I am reserving my right to change my pick any single second of this entire series.
Yeah, that's fair. I knowing what we know now, I say Suns in six. That is subject to change if Chris Paul misses the whole series. Kawhi comes back for game two. No, whatever. So don't get mad, Clippers fans, because I'm saying there's a lot of wiggle room here. But I think the Suns match up a lot better against the Clippers than the Jazz did.
If I told you 3 years ago that one of the Western Conference teams representing the NBA Finals would be the Clippers or the Suns.
Yeah, right?
You would have fired my ass from this podcast.
Clippers, maybe not, because that was like the sputtering end of the Lob City days, but Suns for sure.
Yeah, okay. That's fair.
All right, so we were treated to an epic Game 7 last night with Bucks and Nets, and had Kevin Durant worn one shoe size smaller, we'd be talking about the Nets in the Eastern Conference Finals instead of the Bucks. We don't know who the Bucks are going to play because Sixers-Hawks Game 7 is tonight. But more, I guess, first, Sixers-Hawks Game 7. How are you feeling about that series?
Similar to Suns-Clippers in the sense that I have no idea where this one is going. This is kind of what I'm saying about Game 7s.
Yeah.
Like, you always want me to, like, when we do these things, you ask me where do I lean and how many games, and I'm always telling you, like, a Game 7, you can't before a series go in and say, well, Bucks in 7 or someone else in 7. Like, because Game 7s are unique. We saw that last night with the Bucks as well. Like, it's just, I don't know. The Hawks could go on a run in the first quarter that could be just enough to squeeze it out. Or maybe the Sixers could get in some, like, 2 minutes of Ben Simmons being aggressive, and that's just enough. You know what I mean? It is the margins.
Yeah.
It is a single elimination game at this point. You just have no clue. I don't feel comfortable if I'm Philadelphia because it seems like the Hawks are playing with house money at this point.
Yes.
Like, no one expected them to get this far, so there is no pressure on them whatsoever. They're coming in tonight knowing full well, like, if we lose this one, we're still going to be praised for the run that we had.
Mm-hmm.
The Sixers, on the other hand, if they lose tonight, that is not going to be as well received at all.
No, yeah.
So, and I wonder, which of those two mentalities works in the right team's favor. Like, maybe Trae Young is just coming in like, I have no pressure, so that's why I'm dropping 39 and 18.
Yeah. Right. Ben Simmons, every time he goes to the free throw line, has to be thinking, this could be the last time I take a free throw as a member of the Philadelphia 76ers.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm out now. I'm finally out. I am unshackled by my faith in Ben Simmons now. I'm finally over it. Here's my thing. He's not a playoff performer.
Yeah, I'm saving all of my Ben Simmons. I would call them takes, but it's really slander. I'm going to save it all for the Bye Felicia. But I'm with you. I'm with you.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into it now. Then I'll just wait for that episode.
But, yeah.
And look, let me just say right off the bat, even if they win, I will be of this opinion.
Me too.
Yeah.
I mean, the status of Bogdan Bogdanovic, I'll say, is something to monitor. He is questionable. He left Game 6 with right knee soreness and did not return. I'm assuming he's going to gut it out and play tonight, but how effective he is a big storyline because Trae Young can go, Trae Young can go for 40 and the Sixers can still win if they don't get much from their supporting cast. And Bogdan has been a big part of what the Hawks have done. I think if Bogdan doesn't leave that game, the Sixers probably get closed out on Friday night. Mm. I mean, you know, you're just, Clint Capella is not going to create much offense for you. You know, you're going to get putbacks and lobs, and that's about it for Clint Capella. Kevin Huerter has been very inconsistent. John Collins has been somewhat inconsistent. You know, Gallinari's been good off the bench. Like, you can't count on Lou Williams was their savior in the fourth quarter of Game 5, but he went 0-5 in Game 6. So, I don't know, man. I hope the Sixers Like, I just hope both teams play well. I think we saw in the Bucks-Nets game 7, I don't know if it was nerves. At least Kevin Durant and Giannis were both fantastic, but, like, Chris Middleton was struggling for a while. Drew Holiday struggled the whole damn game, basically, except for one big shot at the end. So I don't want to see, like, you know, Joel Embiid coming out tight and missing his first 5 mid-range shots and Tobias Harris bricking everything he throws up. Like, I want to see a good, well-contested game. I don't care who wins because, frankly, I don't think either one of these teams stands a chance against Milwaukee in the conference finals.
Well, you're obviously lying when you say you don't care. You're going to be rooting for the 76ers. So
honestly, I don't even know. I don't know because I don't. This team is so games 4 and 5 were so frustrating that I don't know if I want to watch 5 more games of Ben Simmons, at least 5 more games of Ben Simmons, and I don't know that I want Joel Embiid putting more wear and tear on his very injured knee. Like, it might be in their best interest if they're going to lose to Milwaukee either way. It might be in their best long term interest to lose this game, but, like, you know, obviously I'll be excited if they win, but. Like, I don't
see that. There we go.
I'll be excited, but, like, I'm not saying it's smart. Like, it's it's probably in their best interest to lose.
And all the crap you gave me when I said I wasn't a Bulls fan anymore, and now you're like, no, I don't care if they win.
I mean, like, if the star setter didn't have a torn meniscus, I would feel differently. But unfortunately, he does, and I'm worried he's just a ticking time bomb at this point.
Right, that one is fair. That I'm still a little bit surprised that he is getting the amount of run that he is, but that really goes to show how desperate they are at this point, no?
Yeah, I mean, Dwight Howard has just gotten beaten like a drum in the last few games every time he's on the court. They are really taking advantage of him. I will say, I mean, Tyrese Maxey in game 6 was phenomenal, and I hope he gets more run. I'll say this much, if the Sixers do advance... And the reason I favor the Bucks over either one of these teams is I just think matchup-wise, the Bucks are a lot better suited to guard either one of these teams than they were the Nets, and that's just really a testament to the offensive prowess of the Brooklyn Nets. But, like, especially if Danny Green misses the first couple games of this series, which it sounds like he will, I don't think you can start Furkan on Korkmaz. I don't think you can have a Curry Korkmaz backcourt or Drew Holiday, who slumped for most of that series. That is his get-right opportunity. I would be curious, matchup-wise, you know, if Philly does advance, like, I would lean toward going Embiid on Giannis right away, Tobias on Brooke Lopez, Ben I would put on Chris Middleton, and then Curry on Pat Connaughton or P.J. Tucker, whoever, I don't care, whoever they start. And then I would probably actually start George Hill and put him on Drew.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Seth Curry to me is the difference maker in that one.
Yeah. Oh, he's been so effing good, man.
Has he been better than Steven Adams?
I mean, if you told me Seth Curry would actually start shooting threes like at a high volume instead of at 5 per game, what? He's taken 12 in game 5 and 9 in game 6.
He's averaging 6.9 for the playoffs. And it should still be more than that.
Yeah, it's about damn time, man. It's like, if you're that good of a 3-point shooter and this team is that desperate for offense, just jack them up.
I'm just saying, when you were like, no, that's Steven Adams, and then you went on Twitter and you made the poll and you were like, no, I'm absolutely sure I'm going to win this. And you know what? People started quote tweeting it like, is this real? Like, rah, 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 rah.
It was 50-50.
It ended up 50-50, but I'm bathing right now in the glory that was that selection, because obviously when you have an elite shooter who is like, is he not the all-time leader in 3-point field goal percentage at this point?
He's up there. I don't know if he is the all-time leader, but he is certainly up there.
All right. Like, when you have someone of that caliber,
yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, of course, like, that just means you have a higher ceiling. And kudos to Doc and the coaching staff for kind of going in and going, oh, maybe you should actually use one of the top 3 shooters in the entire league more.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Right, Ben Simmons can't create any offense for himself, so let's just have him throw the ball to Seth Curry, who I just looked it up, second leading three-point shooter in NBA history in terms of shooting percentage, trailing only Steve Kerr.
Oh, Steve still has the record?
Steve, okay, Steve's at career 45.4%. Seth is at 44.4%.
Yeah.
Joe Harris, who could not shoot a basketball to save his life in that book series, 43.8%. He's fourth on the list.
I really want the Sixers-Bucks series just so we get tall Rondo against tall Westbrook.
Which one's
was that,
which?
That was... Yeah, no, that no. We, Ben Simmons was tall Rondo, okay, and Giannis was tall Westbrook. Was that not Krishna's Krishna Narsu?
Yeah. I mean, I just think the Bucks matchup wise, especially if PJ Tucker's still in the starting lineup, you have Middleton, Tucker, and Giannis against. Like, I think they just have the size to counter the Sixers. So you're right. Seth Curry would be a potential difference maker, but then you could throw Drew on Seth Curry. And stick, who cares, Brooke Lopez on freaking
You know what? George you know Hill. What? I honestly don't necessarily think that Drew would be able to shut down Seth. And I say that as someone who puts a lot of stock into Drew Holiday's defense. Mm-hmm. But Seth right now, Brian, as you are well aware, he's in a different realm. Like, he just in terms of his pull-up game, his handle looks tighter. Like, the rhythm is all the way there. I don't know, man. Like, he seems to just be on another planet in terms of shot selection, understanding when and how, moving off the ball, using screens. I don't know. I think Seth right now is, for the rest of the playoffs, even if that's just one game and maybe it's another series, right now he's performing like an all-star. I think that's fair to say. I mean, he's averaging, 19 plus points in the playoffs, hitting almost 60% from the field, 50 from downtown on, 7 attempts per game. I think that is going to be a trend that continues for the rest of this year. He is loaded right now with weapons and confidence. And with that shooting mechanism of his, I don't trust anyone to, go out there and get, the favorable matchup of the two. Like, you would almost have to put Giannis on him before I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, that's, I mean, if the Bucks stick with what they were starting against Brooklyn, you have Drew, Middleton, Tucker, Giannis, Brooke. All five of those guys are plus defenders. And that's where I think their size is just going to cause a lot of problems, really, for both the Sixers or the Hawks. Like, you can put Drew on Trae Young, and then I just think, Giannis... Clint Capella, I guess, he's not stopping Giannis.
No.
John Collins isn't stopping. I mean, this is where the Hawks, without Reddish and Hunter in particular, their lack of forward depth is really going to bite them in the ass in this series if they advance.
Yeah, but Bogdan Bogdanovic is probably in for, a revenge series at that point.
Dude. Oh, my God. It's just... It is wild to think. The Bucks are probably going to make the finals either way at this point. But it took a lucky break. Really two lucky breaks with Harden and Kyrie going down.
Yeah.
If they had Bogdanovich, if they had just shut their damn mouths in free agency and had gotten Drew and then worked out their signing trade with Bogdanovich, I would have favored them in a fully healthy Nets series.
I have a thought here, and you may correct me if I'm wrong, but if you put Bogdan Bogdanovic on the Bucks right now, does he become the best on-ball self-creator on the team immediately?
Drew is catching a lot of crap right now, and I don't...
No, I get that, but he's still not a reliable offensive player to the...
Right. That's not his primary purpose, at least.
Right.
He'd be up there.
Right.
I still might favor Middleton, actually.
That's fair. That's the one I'm kind of in doubt of as well.
Yeah.
Because Middleton has that little baseline thing that he can get to every single time. I don't know, but I just think it's interesting because to me, that's what Milwaukee needs right now. They need someone who can actually create jump shots for themselves consistently. So And it seems that they don't have a whole lot of those guys. But Bogdanović would fit right into that. And by the way, just before people like get on me about this, last time we talked, I said that Bogdan Bogdanović was a playoff performer. I stand by that. Mm-hmm. His numbers have dwindled. Like, he had a rough stretch against the Sixers. Like, he's down to 40% shooting for the playoffs, under 32 from three. And the numbers don't really look all that pretty. He's not superbly efficient. But, like, before the injury or whatever happened there in Game 6, like, he was still moving well. He was still a threat.
Yeah.
Like, and at no point when he shot the basketball were you like, oh, yeah, that's going to be a miss. Like, you felt the presence of Bogdanović all the time.
Yes.
Like, just because he went through, like, a three, maybe four-game slide, I am not changing my opinion of him as a playoff performer whatsoever.
No. Regardless of what happens tonight, this Hawks team is legit. They have staying power. They're going to be a real threat next year, even if John Collins walks. Like, they're missing at least, you know, Reddish and Hunter. They could be missing Bogdan tonight, and they still took this Sixers team to seven. Like, they are no slander. I will tolerate absolutely zero Hawks slander on the timeline. If the Sixers lose, slander the hell out of them. They deserve it. No Hawks slander whatsoever. And whoever goes to face the Bucks, they should be expected to lose. Right now, I'm looking at FanDuel Sportsbook. The Milwaukee Bucks are currently the favorites to win the NBA championship at plus 160. And I think that's deserved.
Yeah.
I mean, they're without Dante, but, like, given the injury questions with Phoenix and the Clippers, or, you know, COVID for the Suns, Kawhi, Joel Embiid on torn meniscus, the Hawks without any forwards, like, or any wings, I should say, the Bucks, they're never going to have a more open road than they have right now.
No.
And they should still fire Mike Budenholzer.
Right. I'm glad you beat me to it, because I'm still sitting here going, I don't feel confident in them.
No.
I really don't. It's, man, that offense is just ugly. And look, when, I don't know what happened. I haven't read up on the articles after last night. But that whole Brook Lopez snafu, where he didn't realize the clock, and he just threw the ball away.
Oh yeah! Oh my God! Oh yeah! The last possession, like, in the regulation, I think.
Yeah. Like, let's be honest here. If you are at that stage in the playoffs, in that stage in the game too, and you don't know what's on the clock,
is that what happened? I just thought they played good defense, and he was, like, trying to swing the ball, but yeah, I guess he's probably...
No, but he would have known.
Yeah, that's true.
He would have known.
That's true.
What was it? Was it 2.1 that was left on...
Yeah.
Like, he's a guy who he should know. He's a guy who should have known, just off of his experience level, right?
Yeah.
That he wouldn't have had time to make that pass. Nobody would have had time to catch it and shoot. Like, that to me felt like a Chris Webber moment.
Yeah.
Where, and you could see it afterwards, like, the camera zoomed in on him and he was like, what the hell did I just do?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a coaching issue or if it's just offensively the Bucks' brains just turns into ice cream. I don't know what it is.
That's a good place for us to transition, actually, because last time we recorded, where during the episode we found out that Donnie Nelson was going to be leaving the Mavericks.
Oh, yeah.
A few days later, we find out Rick Carlisle is also leaving the Mavericks. So the Mavericks are now in search of a coach and a GM/president, whatever they're going to end up calling it. But everyone had just immediately started penciling two locations for Carlisle. You had been on Carlisle to Boston for a while, but the other one was the Bucks. If Mike Budenholzer lost that series, like, if the Nets had beaten the Bucks last night, Mike Budenholzer is almost 3 p.m. Eastern on Sunday. Mike Budenholzer would have already been fired, and I think Rick Carlisle would have been hired probably today.
Yeah, I will say this. Just in terms of their personalities, it does seem like Rick Carlisle and Giannis would fit each other a little bit better than maybe Luka and Carlisle.
Mm-hmm.
That's not... And by the way, that whole ankle... I feel a little bit strongly about this one. So, okay. So, like, people were like, oh, no, you can't have those two guys. They're the same ilk. They wear their hearts on the sleeves. No, that you can make that work. It's not necessarily that Luca and Carlisle hated each other. It wasn't that. They're two passionate people who are still trying to reach the same goal, and it just didn't work out for whatever reason, and he wanted out. Like, that's fine. But that doesn't mean necessarily that the pairing was wrong. You know what I mean? Like, this ideology that you can't be two people of the same ilk and work together, that's such a man cave perspective to have. That's not how it works. Of course you can have the same sort of personality. That's not the problem. It's just there were so many more things going on in that Mavericks organization, as we now know. I mean, it's an S show, right? I mean, it's complete circus over there right now. But in terms of, like, Giannis, I think he could actually use a guy who comes in wearing his heart on his sleeve a little bit. Like, Bud is... So Bud used to coach in Denmark and play in Denmark. Mm-hmm. So I think he might have adapted a little bit of that Danish laid-back mentality, maybe to a point where you're kind of thinking, no, you should probably go, like, find just a little bit more enthusiasm, a little bit more... like bravado or whatever. And maybe Carlisle is that guy for Giannis. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's the guy who can actually, in important situations, look him in the eye and go, it's your time right now. It is your time, and I'm going to kick your ass if you don't step up. Maybe that's what Ben Simmons needs.
Yeah.
Maybe Ben Simmons needs Rick Carlisle. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. I mean, Carlisle is one of the best coaches in the NBA. He's immediately, much like when the Clippers parted away with Doc Rivers, and all of a sudden, like, it was like, okay, there was a clear number one option on the coaching market, despite Doc's flaws, a lot of which have popped up in this series. He was still the best hire on the market last summer. Rick Carlisle immediately vaults to the top of every team's list. He has his choice of jobs. So I guess if you're a Carlisle, Mort, do you wait to see what happens with Milwaukee now, knowing the path that is ahead of them, that they very well could win the championship this year? Do you wait to see if, whatever reason, they collapse against the Sixers or the Hawks or whoever, Suns, Clippers, whoever, and push off the Celtics job? Or do you just say, you know what, I know that opportunity is possibly there, but the Celtics one, if they offer this to me, I'm just going to take it because I still get Jason Tatum. I still get Jaylen Brown.
Right.
You know, historic franchise, obviously. Like, that we might as well take what I know could happen, because the other risk is if you wait for the Bucks job, they don't fire Bud and the Celtics fill their vacancy. All of a sudden, you're like, well, I guess I'm going to Indiana.
Yeah. I think he needs to be very careful with that. I believe he is president of the National Basketball Coaches Association. Is that correct?
I'm not 100% sure, but that sounds right.
Yeah. So that also means he really has to not step on toes. So if he's like angling for a job where there's already someone there, I don't think he would ever do that.
Yes.
I think he is like the type of person, especially with that role, who's just going, no, I'm not going to meddle. Like, if there's an open position, that is what I will consider. I won't be hanging out to see what's there. that it wouldn't shock me if he takes that approach, honestly. And maybe just because of that signs with Boston. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he is like thinking, you know, it's all fair game when a guy gets canned. Mm-hmm. So I can wait around, which in my personal opinion, that would be fine. Like, I wouldn't have a problem with that if he did that. I don't think that would be sleazy or anything. That's how the game is played.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, when you have a position like that, you have to be careful. No, I would imagine.
Yeah. No, that's a completely fair point. And again, I mean, there's a real chance the Bucks win the finals, and as much as we're going to joke about they should still fire Bud, no team is going to fire their coach after they won the NBA finals.
No, they still should.
Right, they should, but they won't. So there's a real chance. Like, there is risk in waiting out the Milwaukee job. I think the best case scenario for Carlisle would have been the Bucks losing to the Nets last night, and then losing to a Nets team without Kyrie, with James Harden on one leg. There is no way the Bucks would have been able to retain Mike Budenholzer. But like I tweeted last night, it's like hilarious that they're going to be stuck with this guy, even though Rick Carlisle is on the market, because things just broke in their favor throughout the playoffs.
Yeah. I wonder if there's like a sneaky team out there. I don't remember who said this. It was, you know, one of the writers on NBA Twitter. You know, oh God, we're so many people.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Right.
Someone just made someone wrote a tweet saying, if you don't love your coach, you fire him just for a Rick Carlisle interview.
Yeah. There are very few teams. Miami should not. I would not. I mean, right. I think Spoelstra is just, he's so into that, like, he is the foundation of that team. The Spurs,
you love him so much that you still can't pronounce his name. It's amazing.
Yeah, whatever.
Spoelstra.
Yeah. The Spurs, they're just not going to fire Pop. This is not.
No, but if he resigns, that could be an interesting, like. And by the way, I don't hope he will be, but there apparently were some rumblings about that or whatever, but we don't know.
Yeah. Other than that, like, I don't think Phoenix would, because Monty's been so successful with them this year.
Yeah, no dice. No dice.
The Warriors won't because of Steve Kerr. Steve Kerr and Steph are tied to the hip. Other than that, can you think of another team that at least shouldn't be open? I mean, the Raptors, I don't think would for Nick Nurse.
No, I don't think they would, but I wouldn't hate it. I mean, I wouldn't. It's not something I would close the door on entirely. I would have it a little bit open. But you're right. It's not like a fully fledged open door.
Right. And like, I don't think the Sixers would.
I was just about to say that. You're absolutely right. I don't think they would either.
But I wouldn't. They're in that same boat where it's like, I wouldn't hate it if they did. The only way I would do it is if I am sure I'm getting Rick Carlisle. Like, I'm not firing Doc Rivers on the off chance that I get him. But if I know that Rick Carlisle is interested and he like back channels and says, I'm yours if you want me, I don't know. You would have to at least entertain it.
Well, so there's one thing. There's one thing, one team I'm thinking about here, which is also, and this, I'm only thinking of them, but this could be applied to more teams. So like, let's take a team like Chicago with Billy Donovan.
Oh my God.
Obviously. No. I don't disagree with you. Yeah. I would take Rick Carlisle over Billy Donovan any day of the week.
Right.
I'm not saying otherwise. But I think in terms of like when they have a guy who has been used to coaching changes, a Zach LaVine that is, and who finally broke out under a certain guy and finally like is vocal about, oh, we have some stability, I think some teams would hesitate, even with Rick Carlisle available, to go.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we saw.
Do we want to do this?
We saw Sacramento and Mike Malone. I think it was. Was it Malone or Dave Yeager? I think it was Malone, right? When they started off really well, and then Boogie got mono.
That was Mike Malone.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden they just fell into complete disarray for years on end.
Yeah, and then they hired George Karl and everything went to hell.
Yeah. So, yes, there's definite risk there. And, like, that's the thing. I think, like, Utah and Denver would be two really interesting ones, because both, in theory, should not have any, like, those guys should not be on the hot seat. But especially seeing what happened to the Jazz in the playoffs after the regular season they just had. And I guess there was some frustration with Mike Malone in Denver, even though, again, Austin Rivers, like, how many times do I have to say Austin Rivers or Campacho versus Chris Paul and Devin Booker? Like, it's not his fault, but he did like accuse his team of quitting during the playoffs, which is not an especially great look.
It's not. Would you, if you're LeBron James, would you fire Frank Vogel?
Yes. Immediately.
Yeah, I would too.
And that's not to say Frank Vogel is a bad coach, but it's like, you're asking, if I had Rudy Gay, would I try to get Kevin Durant?
That was super rough.
But like, right? I mean, it's
like, what did Rudy Gay do to
you? Okay, fine. If I had Chris Middleton, would I try to get, if I could get Kevin Durant instead of Chris Middleton?
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
If you don't have one of the top, top tier guys, like the Clippers are another team, especially what Ty Lue.
Oh, I have a good one then. Okay. I'm sorry, but I have a good one then. The Knicks.
In a heartbeat.
Just why? Okay, but look, here's the thing. He just overachieved. He won Coach of the Year. I don't think he should have won it, but
no.
Okay. He won Coach of the Year. He just overachieved with a roster that really wasn't that good.
Yeah.
Like, that's a tough sell publicly as well. Like, your PR is going to go through the toilet for the first couple of months.
Right. They won't do it, but they should be open to it.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I'm just saying, like, the PR angle also comes into effect here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, the Knicks, for example, I think he would be fantastic in New York. But, every chip is kind of lined up Tom Thibodeau's way.
Yeah.
So, like, getting rid of him to go with someone who's better, it would be such a tough sell for that organization.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm looking at this just abstractly, not in terms of which teams will do it. Because you're right. Like, the Knicks, just like the Bucks, would not fire Bud if they won the finals, even though they should. The Knicks are not going to fire Tom Thibodeau coming off of their most successful season in, like, almost a decade. Even though, you're right, he won Coach of the Year because the Knicks have sucked for so long that anyone, the first person to make them half good again, was going to automatically get more praise than they should have. Even though it is much more difficult to go from good to great than it is from bad to good. Monty Williams taking the Suns from good to great, which he did this year, I think is more difficult than Tom Thibodeau just playing his best players 38 minutes a game during the regular season.
I think that's fair. I'm just saying the PR angle. And by the way, we're sitting here bringing up all of those names. I'm bringing up Boston. You're bringing up Milwaukee. He's probably going to sign a contract with the Pelicans.
I wouldn't hate that.
I wouldn't either. I think if you're the Pelicans, that's the guy you go for.
Yeah. Or Portland.
Yeah. So, yeah, but if you're Carlisle, wouldn't you rather want to go a place where there seems to be more stability?
Well, that's a good way to transition, because does there seem to be more stability in New Orleans?
I mean, you don't have a GM who goes to the press and says it's everybody else's fault, though.
Right. Well, no, I guess, David Griffin kind of fell on the sword for Stan Van Gundy. Right. Or he at least knows how to play the media game better than Neil Olshey does.
That's fair. That is fair. This might be a media game thing, but okay. Yeah, no. I still think the upside of the Pelicans. But let's go into it. Let's go into what happened with New Orleans, because good lord,
man. So, Shams Charania, Joe Vardon, William Guillory of The Athletic. This is the first paragraph of the article they published. I think this was Thursday. Parting ways with Stan Van Gundy after just one season is not the biggest problem facing the New Orleans Pelicans.
Yeah.
They have been unable to put together the right elements to make rising star Zion Williamson and his family happy. And multiple sources have told The Athletic that certain family members want Williamson on another team. They added, sources from all corners have pointed to the Pelicans as a heap of dysfunction for months. There was a growing unease between Van Gundy and his players and Van Gundy and the New Orleans front office, which came to a head when they parted ways. Most of the attention, however, from numerous sources around the league, has centered on Williamson's family members' thinly veiled unhappiness with the Pelicans and whether those feelings seeped into the players' own views. So, Mort, we have Uncle Dennis 2.0 on our hands here.
Obviously not great, and I'm not going to sit here and say the Pelicans don't have issues to work out, but I'm just saying, let's not make it a glamour situation in Portland either. But I hear you. This is bad. This is really bad, because when meddling starts, especially for family members and especially for a guy this young, has he even turned 21 yet? Has he just? No, he's not. That's next month, early next month. He's 20 years old. At what point does it become almost too soon to start complaining? You catch my drift here, right? When you are the number one overall pick, you're the number overall pick for a reason. One thing is you're good, but the team that drafts you presumably has been really crappy the year before.
Right. Barring like massive lottery luck. Yes.
Yes. Unless this was a 1982 situation where the champion Los Angeles Lakers got the number one pick and drafted James Worthy. Right. Yes.
Or exactly. I mean, even like the Warriors last year where they just had some bad injury luck.
Right.
You know. But yes, like you are more often than not going to a completely garbage team. And as the number one pick, it is your responsibility to help turn things around.
Yeah. Sion and his family seems to be living in this world where he's a star, so he needs to get that accommodation immediately. And I don't necessarily disagree with that notion on its own. He is, like, dude averaged 27-7 in his second year. I mean, what he did was ridiculous. Like, shot 61% from the field. I think he murdered 17 people just by going off of dunks and like secondary jumps inside. Like he was insane. So I'm not saying that the quality of play is the issue. I'm saying you're 20 years old. Your family has to realize you're basically just stopped being a teenager. Mm-hmm. You can't expect that an NBA franchise within 2 years will pivot and become a championship contender. You can't. And I understand that they had aspirations for the playoffs and they didn't make it. That's all fine and well. But you know what? You still have a fellow star alongside you in Brandon Ingram. You have a lot of young guys who presumably are going to do very well in the future. I mean, hell, I'm super high on Kyra Lewis, for example. He just didn't get a whole lot of minutes. Mm-hmm. Next year, that's going to look a lot different. He's going to be better. Jackson Hayes is going to be better. There are a lot of, like, Nikhil Alexander-Walker. Najee Marshall stepped up. Like, there are a lot of components here that are working in the Pelicans' favor. And if Zion and his family can't see that, then I think it's on them. Like, that's not to say David Griffin doesn't need to go out there and do whatever he can to make the product competitive. Mm-hmm. But I think he is. Like, I think he's trying. Like, firing your coach, or at least mutually decides to part ways, is one of those situations where, you know, he didn't live up to expectations. So now Griffin's job is to go out there and find a better coach. Like, he's doing his job. So I just don't understand what Zion's family think they're getting out of this. Because if they get it into the heads of multiple GMs around the league that Zion is going to be one of those guys who complains mm-hmm. for the rest of his career, like, and this early too, and wants this instant gratification thing on him, I don't think that's going to work out for them.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I mean, I found this part interesting from the Athletic article. The Pelicans, when they traded J.J. Redick to Dallas, it not only upset Redick, but it also is said to have irritated Williamson because Redick wanted to either stay in New Orleans or go back to the East Coast to be close to his family. And then when that didn't happen, he was very open about his frustration with David Griffin and the organization. Apparently, the dysfunction Redick accused the Pelicans of harboring is said to have stoked some of Williamson's own feelings with regard to the direction of the franchise. And look, I mean, the Pelicans were always going to take a step back this year. Trading Drew Holiday, right. Despite how poorly he just played in that series, Drew Holiday is a very, very good player. Trading him away for Eric Bledsoe was not going to work out in the Pelicans' short-term favor. Where it does work out is that they got a ton of draft picks for him. And that, like, we saw when the Pelicans had Anthony Davis and they tried to push. The Pelicans now are doing the exact opposite of what they did when they had Anthony Davis, where they're like, oh, crap, we have the star. We have to win right away. We have to win now. And they just, like, Omer Asik, giving him a giant contract. That turned out to be an immediate mistake. And I'm not saying that David Griffin has nailed every move that he's made. The Redick thing, it was not a great look. If you really promised that you were either staying in New Orleans or were sending you to the East Coast, and then they were like, nah, actually, here's what we're going to do instead.
Yeah,
I can understand being frustrated by that. The Bledsoe contract is a disaster, and how they get off of that is worth monitoring. Steven Adams, did you need to give him a 2-year extension? I don't know. It might not work out.
Right, right.
You know, like, so I'm not saying David Griffin is perfect here, but I think their plan so far has at least their overarching plan has made sense. And so I'm with you. It's like the Pelicans do not necessarily need to be in win now mode, or they shouldn't be in win now mode, because they just don't have the pieces they need to win now, but they're building toward that. And you just can't skip steps often, like unless you're the Nets and you can sign Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving in the same summer, and all of a sudden, okay, yeah, you can skip steps. But even the Nets, it took them a couple years to rebuild and get a Caris LeVert and Jared Allen and a Spencer Dinwiddie, all of whom they used except for Dinwiddie, in that trade for James Harden, and that completed the puzzle as well. So, like, rebuilds take time in the NBA, and at some point...
And they have picks.
Yeah, right. They have picks and they have young players. Like, at some point, they will be able to accelerate, but it's just not quite there yet. And Zion, who's, like, I don't know why his family's operating, like, I mean, I guess, you know, maybe he is a ticking time bomb, but hopefully not. Hopefully he stays healthy and has a productive 10, 15, 28-year NBA career, and this is just going to be a minor blip on his resume. Like, as far as we know, the Pelicans are going to be in the playoffs next year, and they have no reason to be upset. But the other thing that came out shortly after this Athletic article was John Hollinger of The Athletic, who reported, oh, by the way, the Pelicans are only committed to their lease New Orleans through 2024, and sources have consistently mentioned them as the most likely team to seek relocation in the coming decade. So now that is hanging over the franchise's head as well. He hedged. He said, you know, the owner, Gail Benson, is deeply connected to New Orleans and not currently seeking to sell, but losing money while finishing in the lottery has not been an enjoyable side venture to the main business of running the Saints. So I think that could also increase the pressure to take shortcuts and maybe get back to the playoffs so you could at least become more profitable. But that's not necessarily the best thing for Zion Williamson and for maximizing your championship upside. So there's definitely some stuff to monitor here moving forward, because it does not sound like everything is peachy keen, much like in Dallas with the red wedding of the front office. It sounds like the Pelicans are also dealing with some behind the scenes stuff that is not ideal when you have a early 20 something superstar on your roster.
Absolutely. That said, Williamson is not making matters better by having his family going to the media. So one thing, I get what you're saying. Like, if the Pelicans promised J.J. Redick, we're going to move you to a certain place, like, okay, I'll be pissed too if that didn't come to fruition. But J.J. Redick is an NBA player earning tens of millions of dollars per year. And all that he's talked about over the past 2 years is, oh, my family. Then retire. Like, if that's your priority in life, which is totally fine, then retire.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand. Like, you signed the contract.
Right. Don't sign with the Pelicans if you were that concerned.
It's almost like, it's like the minute after he signed, it's like, oh, my family. Like, you know what you signed up for, though.
Right.
Like, he's coming off so poorly in my eyes with the whole family angle all the time. Like, I don't blame him for wanting to see his family, but then, you know what? Then sign a lesser contract closer to home if that's where your priority is.
Yes.
Like, that's fine. But if you took the money and went to New Orleans and you signed a perfectly normal uniform contract, as it's called, that also means that you're subject to get traded to wherever the hell the franchise wants you to be traded to. Right. I'm just so tired of him basically, I don't know, it might just be him being a begrudging old man saying, I don't want to, you know, I simply don't want to abide by the normal NBA standard of getting traded.
Right.
I deserve this and this and that. You know what, man? There are so many guys in the NBA who get traded, and you won't hear them talk this game. Like, they won't complain.
Yeah.
That's just what it is. I get it. I completely agree with J.J. Redick when it comes to if the organization promised him something. Yes, that is wrong. If they promised him something and didn't do it, that is vile. But at the same time, man, you have to understand what you're signing on to.
Right.
That bothers me. Finally, I'm going to ask, and I'm not going to do the whole hot take thing. I'm just going to ask you, because you brought it up yourself. You said ticking time bomb. If the team that holds the number one pick calls you up and says, Cade for Zion.
This year.
What do you do if you're the Pelicans?
Ooh.
You now know that you have a very, very special talent on your hands.
Yeah.
You also know that he is probably likely to have a negative attitude towards you via the family. Like you said, Uncle Dennis 2.0, that is not something to be taken lightly. No. I don't care what anybody says, that is not something you take lightly.
Yeah.
And at the same time, this was your comment, and I agree with it, ticking time bomb. You know that that's a lot of weight on those knees. Do you instead just say, you know what, we'll take the PR hit and Kate instead, who by all intents and purposes are projected to have better longevity, at the very least?
It's a tough question. I would lean no, or at least ask for more.
Yeah, just I would too.
Just because of the Markelle Fultz situation from a couple of years ago. Because Markelle Fultz, and that's not to say that Cade and Markelle Fultz are on the same level of prospect. I think Cade is considered to be much more of a like high level potential super, like multiple time All-Star MVP potentially. But Markelle was pretty widely considered a can't miss guy.
Yeah, he was Dwayne Wade with a three pointer.
Except he didn't have a three pointer.
Well, he did in college, right?
But you know, like there's always risk. Until these guys get to the NBA, you see how they translate. Right. Like, as much as a guy is a can't-miss, like, Cade Cunningham is clearly the number one prospect.
Yeah.
And we think he's going to be great, and he should be great. There's no reason to think that he won't be. But you just can't be 100% sure until you see it. We've seen it with Zion. You know, he was the number one guy. There were some concerns about whether his physical dominance would translate to the NBA. It did. We get he is
big time.
He's amazing. He's, as long as he stays healthy, you know, he has incredible, incredible upside. So yeah, if I'm the Pelicans, like I'm not saying no. I'm not Zion Williamson is not untouchable, especially given all of this other stuff going on.
Yeah.
But I would want more. I would want the number one plus
something else.
Yeah, like probably another unprotected first.
Yeah.
What about you?
No, I think that's very, very fair. I'm of the similar line. What I just basically wanted to gauge is the entire, how does this affect his, you know, in our perception, of course, trade value. Because, like, having that guy, or having that guy, I don't even know if it's one guy, like, family members. You know, it's because I'm getting Uncle Dennis flashbacks.
Yeah, oh, totally.
Having these people, like, meddle it can be such murder on a locker room.
Yeah.
It can literally split a locker room. And it's, if you are going to lean into that sort of behavior, I, as an NBA organization, would know that there's a ceiling to how far we can get or to how far we can go.
Yeah.
I would know that if you are not fully on board on certain things, and if we don't accommodate you in every which way possible, then we risk having negative articles come out. We risk having anonymous person from Zion's camp says yada, yada, yada. And we would get consistently undermined by those people. And to me, that matters if I'm an NBA organization. I don't want that.
Yeah.
I don't want my players to undermine what we're trying to do. I want to be on the same page with you. I don't want to be in a media war with you. So if this is the type of behavior that could be anticipated moving forward, and I'm not saying it is, but I'm just saying we know right now of this situation, I would, at the very, very least, be open to taking phone calls in terms of the right package. Like like at you, I'm not going to go, oh, you're offering me a sign and trade at Dennis Schroeder? Like, No. It has to be an absolutely, like, insanely good offer.
Yeah.
Of course it'd be. Like, even if the Warriors called up and offered, you know, the Wiseman and the Minnesota pick and all that, I would be like, I still need more.
Yeah.
I'm still going to need more.
Yeah.
But Cade is a different one, though. I think Cade specifically, and if, like, you add in another pick, like, we don't know who gets number one, obviously.
Right.
So if that number one team also has another young player on their roster, I would also ask for him.
Yes.
But just the point that I wouldn't decline that call, I think speaks volumes, honestly.
Yeah. No, I don't think, like, Zion Williamson talent-wise is of the caliber of guy who should effectively be untouchable.
Yes.
But I don't think that he should be for New Orleans.
So we are going to get so many angry messages from Mason Ginsburg and Shamit Dua,
but like,
our friends of the podcast.
If someone's willing to offer just an absolute godfather, yeah. Like, you know, it depends on, like, I'm not like you. Poor Dennis Schroeder, by the way. Like, caught so many strays on this episode. But yeah, it would obviously depend on what the franchise is offering. But
yeah,
if they're offering, you know, similar to it is, translate the return that you got for Drew Holiday, but just up it considering the talent right. for Zion. But if you're offering a James Harden package, where it's like yeah. every single pick for the next 8 years, plus something great, plus the number one, or like, you know, the number one plus two more picks and two pick swaps, you have to consider it. That you're just,
what about,
you can't be
OKC.
If OKC got number one?
If OKC got the number one and they also got number five.
Mm.
And that's the trick. Number one and number five for Zion.
So you're looking at like Cade and Kuminga?
Yeah.
You have to entertain it. You at least have to assess how bad this family situation is.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's really what I wanted to... That's where I should have started.
Yeah.
That's where I should have started. You have to figure out first and foremost... How serious is this thing? I mean, I think it's pretty serious when it hits the news feeds in this manner.
Yeah.
And like, also what worries me is it says family members. That concerns me as well. That means yeah. there are a lot of voices out there apparently trying to have opinions on behalf of Zion. And if Zion is leaning into those concerns or mumblings or whatever, oh man, that is, maybe I'm just old school. Maybe it's because I'm from Europe and I don't like all that way of thinking. I think you need to be, if you're with a sports team, I think you need to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. I think you need to dedicate yourself to that team while you're under contract. I think it and of course the organization has to dedicate themselves to you as well. It has to be a marriage. But then you can't have all those opinions come in and you can't like start a revolution from within. I don't think that helps anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. Man. What a mess.
It really is.
All right. Well,
game time in 5 minutes, Brian.
Yeah. All right. We will get going. So thank you as always for listening. We will be back soon. We'll have draft lottery to talk about and we'll have some bye Felicias for the second round of the playoffs. So stay tuned. We got a lot of good stuff coming up. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. You're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Happy Father's Day, especially to all the other first-time dads out there. We have survived for however many months your child has been alive, and they are presumably also alive. So that's a big win.
That's a win.
And Mort, until next time, I'm Brian Toporek. I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one.
You too.